Good morning. I'm sharing a quote from the poet Johannes Gärtner, who is a theologian, poet, and art history professor. He said that to speak gratitude is courteous and pleasant. To enact gratitude is generous and noble. But to live gratitude is to touch heaven. And I want to encourage you today, as you hear and receive from this special service, that you ask God and your own spirit to find one truth that can help you to live gratitude and thereby know that every day, not just when you come to church, but every day you can be like the heroes of faith that are mentioned at the top of your program and touch heaven in a way that those that don't understand gratitude can't even understand. Let's take a moment and ask that we be open, to what we're going to hear, and that we not just hear with our ears, but hear with our hearts, and that each one of us take away that pearl of great price, and it will be a different one for each person here. But by taking it away and seeing how we can put that one pearl into practice, we can touch heaven. Amen. I'm back. I'm also getting old. I'm going to read from Psalm 95, verses 1 through 7. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to him with psalms, for the Lord is the great God and the great King above all gods. In his hand are the deep places of the earth. The heights of the hills are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand.
The second reading is the 23rd Psalm, always my favorite. My son and I used to recite this when he was a very young child. This was his bedtime prayer. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures and leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And now for one of the best parts, we're going to have the professional come up and give us her reflection on the 91st Psalm. And this is really her favorite. That's the reason why we picked it, so.
Good. I like to move around a little. Well, I'm going to read the entire psalm out loud first, and then I'm just going to touch on some of my favorite high points, because I really could take a month of Sundays just on this one psalm and give you a complete sermon each one of those Sundays just on this one psalm. So we can't do that today. He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 may fall at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked, because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For He shall give His angels charge over you to keep you in all of your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash a foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot. Because He has set His love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high, because he has known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. And I want to start by clarifying that wherever we see the word him, we can take it to be an all-inclusive. Him, her, or if you really want to make it personal, you can read it saying, with long life will he satisfy me and show me his salvation. You can do that with the Bible. It's okay. He's not going to throw a lightning bolt. I love this psalm because of the way it just takes everything that at any time can come against us in our personal life and show how He's bigger and stronger if we just abide, like I said, in that spirit of gratitude, if we just live in our faith and live out our faith. So let's go back to the first verse, because there is some imagery in verse 1 and 4 that I just love. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. And we're going to jump to verse 4. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. Now let me tell you something that I've learned. Apparently, when a giant eagle is going to teach her babies how to fly, of course, we know the mother pushes them out of the nest. But what the eagle does is then they soar and they get to where the babies are just flapping their wings and they're just right above them, gently soaring. And the force of their large wings creates this wonderful vacuum in the area where their babies are flying. So their babies are just flapping their little wings going, look, mommy, I'm flying. And they don't know that it's because the mother has taken away all of the effort. Isn't that great? And then when we fly a little bit out of it, we realize it's windy and we get back in under where it's protected. So as we're flying through life and holding firm to our faith, we are flying in that space of protection and ease. It's not denying that the storms are there. It's not denying that the winds would like to suck us out into the storm. But it's saying if you can hold fast to that faith that is yours, to that spirit of gratitude, then you're flapping your wings in this great little vacuum thinking you're doing all the work when it's not you. And that is what it's supposed to be. Living a life of faith is supposed to be easy. And here is the trick of where people sometimes realize life has become difficult. The trick comes in verse 5, where it talks about how you shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor the destruction that lays waste at noonday, because even though 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 may fall at your right hand, it shall not come near you unless you do give in to that fear. We all have, most of us, I believe, are still blessed to have two arms. Am I correct? Do we all have two arms? Can I see them? Oh, you look like Pentecostals. Gotcha. So imagine that one arm, with all of the muscles and all of the bone structure and all of its strength, is named fear. And imagine that our other arm, with all of the same muscles and the same bone structure and pretty similar strength, is named faith. Generally, if one arm wants to go this way and the other arm wants to go that way, we're stuck in the middle, aren't we? You know what makes the decision between fear and faith? Your words. Your words can decide, are you staying under that wonderful span of protection in your faith? Or have your words started giving in to the fear that attacks us all at different times? No human being is immune. No human being is immune to the fear of sickness or the fear of old age or the fear of cancer or the fear of an attack or the fear of a robbery or the fear of a violent crime. No human being is immune to feeling fear. It's not a sin to face fear. But your words decide which arm is leading, the arm of faith or the arm of fear. It's all in your hands, in your words. And that is such a relief. It's not just some ambiguous force that decides my life, it's my words. And if I come to realize that somehow my spirit of gratitude, my life of faith has been tripped up, I'm in a position to help make it better. That gives you the freedom to decide where you go with your faith, with your life of gratitude. And that puts the decision on you to what degree you can enjoy that sense of ease and protection. If it's not there, it's not because you've done anything wrong, except maybe just not realized where words have made the decision for you. But you can change your words. That's an easy thing. It is. And when we do that, the protection that comes on us is a protection that covers not just our fears, but it also covers our physical health. It covers our spiritual health. It covers every area of our lives when we can choose that life of gratitude and that life of faith. And some of us might have an easier time of others. There is a way to say, God, put a guard at my mouth so that I don't sin against you. That's not saying that words are sin. It's just saying, I want to pay more attention to what's coming out of here, so that I enjoy more of that ease under your wings. That's all it's saying. That's an easy prayer to pray, isn't it? And I'm saying, by living your life of faith, we're not judged by how much faith we have, because that's not fair. We can easily compare ourselves to somebody and think, oh, that's it. I'm done. We're not even judged by whether it's the same faith as somebody has. We're only judged by walking in our own faith and by staying true to it here, here, and here. And I hope that somebody comes out feeling like that's something they can use. That's an easy thing to work on, because our life of faith shouldn't be difficult. It should be easy. And the end of this, and I'm not ignoring the grammar of this psalm, because yes, it changes verb context throughout it, but that's okay. The end of it is, with long life will he satisfy us and show us his salvation. If you're not satisfied with your life, then you have a reason to stick around longer, don't you?
So part of this comes from discussions that I had recently. And it was kind of a new age kind of crowd, and it was kind of this image of sort of evolving beyond God. You know, God was like not quite as relevant. I mean, you know, kind of a historical figure, maybe. Somebody from way in the past. And we don't really use this word very often, but to me that's kind of heresy, you know? But I began thinking, you know, maybe it's because people really don't discuss it a lot. So the first question is, like, to you, really, who or what is God? When you really think about it, who or what is God? Does a storybook image, like a white-haired patriarch sitting on a throne in the clouds, flood into your consciousness? It's usually the first example you get. Or is God more of an outgrown fable? You know, I mean, certainly more sanctified and dignified, but really, no more existent than like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. I mean, you know, who or what is God? The essence of God is pure consciousness, infinite possibilities and endless unfoldment. There's no end to it. Humans are created by God as a reflection of God's image, which is the cause for enormous optimism among the humans. One of the problems is that we have a tendency to reverse the theology. We're not reflections of God's nature. We seek to create God in our own image. This is kind of inevitable for finite beings like ourselves. We cannot really conceive of an infinite being, and yet making God in our own image is a really brazen act of impudence. I mean, making God fit our image is really the original sin. God is far beyond. The human mind is limited, but God is infinite. It is impossible for our limited mind to grasp infinity except in small, disconnected fragments, often by prophets. When these fragments of images by prophets are codified in somebody's religious dogma, they become the image of God for millions of believers, whether they're true or not. God, beyond human understanding and without any limitation, is the core of every faith belief system. Then each faith institution applies a myriad of limitations upon the divinity. Shall we give God a gender? An age, motives, jealousies. Shall we describe the behavior and the motives of the divine in which way, in ways that might indicate manipulation or neurosis or psychosis or what? Can we psychoanalyze God? Can we diagnose the faults of God? Of course we can't. How can we presume to fit the infinite into human form? There is another way to view God as the source of consciousness and the vital creative spring from which we get our mind, our creativity, and above all, our ability to evolve and grow. God is not static. That's the great hope of prophecy. Once you drop the storybook image of a patriarch sitting on his throne, room is made for a different revelation: God beyond understanding. To know God by standing apart, looking, analyzing her nature and being doesn't work. With God, the opposite is true. The less your limited consciousness inhibits God's impotence, inhibits God's omnipotence, the greater the fulfillment of your soul. The path of the pilgrim starts anywhere and leads everywhere. The infinity has no itinerary. You do not outgrow God. You cannot evolve beyond the Creator. God expands as your journey progresses. You are part of God and part of God's plan. You cannot exist outside of the divinity. As mystics, we have a story of how everything began and of what God is. One of the odd things that I noticed in my religious journey was that the mystics of all faiths basically had the same story when you distilled it down, no matter what religion it was. Mystics have more in common theologically with each other than they do with the other adherents of their faith. And that's why usually in times of madness and turmoil, they kill the mystics first. But as I've told you, it all distills down into sort of like one basic story, whether you're a Jewish mystic or Buddhist mystic or wherever. Any kind of Christian, any kind of Eastern religion, if you read the Native American versions, it all comes out to be the same. This version is a little bit closer to Native American, but they're all really about the same. In the beginning was the One. And the One was all, and all was one. Being all, the One could not know itself. So God initiated the process of creation to learn about her nature. The divinity, which was all, emanated out vibrations of energy, so that the return of the vibrations would bring self-knowledge to the One. At first, the vibrations were extremely diaphanous, but gradually they began to grow more coarse. Increased coarseness brought more detailed self-knowledge to the One, until the vibrations began to have mass and eventually form and life and will, and so the One could know itself. The process continues in perpetuity. All of the vibrative material continues to be part of the all. All emanations eventually return to the all. We are one with the all. To know we are actually one with the all is one of the most wonderful revelations of all time. It gives us hope beyond hope. Our place in creation becomes clear. We are part of the ever-evolving oneness. For this, we should be filled with gratitude and peace of mind. To be thankful to God is supreme among all virtues. To be grateful and to give thanks to God is to worship her as best and beautiful and glorious and gracious. Thankfulness to God is also sweet to the soul. It brings us joy. Learn to be thankful and you'll be healthier in mind and in body. And you'll be a blessing to others. The Bible teaches this. Psychological research bears it out. And our common experience proves it out. We have all met people who are thankful and cheerful, spreading the life-giving aroma of the blessing, even in dire circumstances. We've seen how they persevere with a positive outlook in the face of evil. We've been blessed by their refreshing spirituality of trusting in God. We've learned that even if they're suffering physically, their prognosis is improved because of their gratitude. And if their crisis is not curable, they face their fate with an uplifted heart and gratitude for all they've received. How can they be so thankful in unfairness, with difficulty, or with pain? And I'm going to choose the answer from the 46th Psalm. Because they're drinking from the river whose streams make glad the city of God. Blessed be, and amen.
It's hard to know what the closing words should be when you didn't really know what the other part of the message was going to be. So I actually held off and trusted that the right words would come to me. So I'm going to read, even though much of today's service was certainly focused on the Old Testament, I'm going to read from the New Testament, which also focuses on the Old Testament. In Hebrews chapter 12, and remember that at the time that the Bible was written, you may sit, by the way, sorry. At the time that the Bible was written, there were no separations of chapters and verses. A writer wrote as the Spirit led, and later on, hundreds of years later, scholars and scribes and clerks decided to somehow make the whole shebang easier for us to tear apart. And they put in these separations that we now call chapters and verses. All of Hebrews 11 is what I call the Great Hall of Faith. Instead of the Hall of Fame, it's talking about all the great heroes of faith that are presented throughout the Old Testament. And continuing in that vein, Hebrews chapter 12 reads, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin," or I'll call fear, "which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." We've heard some wonderful words. And if you come out of here feeling in any way comforted and uplifted, that's a wonderful thing. If you come out of here saying, "I can put something into practice to enjoy my life better," that's even better. Because to me, church is all about giving the people something that they can take home and not talk over Sunday dinner, but actually put into their lives and see their lives improve. And in that vein, I want to encourage you that you share those things that most penetrated your heart and soul and choose to set aside fear and run the race of faith that is set before you, which includes living in gratitude day by day. And I think that's something we all want to use as a goal in our lives. So as we close today and we're going to gather together in our great circle, let's find out as we sing our closing circle, what do we take away from today? Start finding your spot and finding who you're going to hold hands with.